Welcome. This is an audio recording of the World Affairs Council of Dallas-Fort Worth. I'm Jim Falk, President of the Council. The Council is a nonprofit membership organization dedicated to engaging the public in an exploration of global issues and foreign affairs, and we produce over 80 public events each year. To learn more about us or to become a member, visit dfwworld.org. This podcast is made possible through the generous support of Haynes & Boone, LLP. We hope you enjoy it.
Tonight, I'm privileged to welcome two scholars in the field of political science and international relations. John J. Mearsheimer is the R. Wendell Harrison Distinguished Professor of Political Science at the University of Chicago. He currently serves as the institution's co-director of the Program on International Security Policy. He has published several works, including the most recent text, The Tragedy of Great Power Politics. Stephen M. Walt is the Robert and Renee Belfer Professor of International Affairs at the John F. Kennedy School of Government at Harvard. He has also been a member of the faculties of Princeton and the University of Chicago. He has published most recently Taming American Power, The Global Response to U.S. Primacy, and Beyond Bin Laden, Reshaping U.S. Foreign Policy. These two acclaimed authors have co-written the book that serves as the subject of tonight's program, The Israel Lobby. Ladies and gentlemen, please join me in giving a Texas welcome to Professors John Mearsheimer and Stephen Walt.
Thank you very much for that very warm welcome, and Bruce, thank you for the kind introduction and for agreeing to moderate the discussion. We are, needless to say, looking forward to a lively conversation with you after we're done with our presentations. We're going to discuss two main questions today. First is there a powerful pro-Israel lobby in the United States, and if so, how does it work? And second, on balance, is its impact positive or negative for the United States and also for Israel? Now, I'm going to tackle the first question, and John is going to address the second. But before I get started, I want to acknowledge how difficult it is to raise this subject openly and why it does need to be handled with some sensitivity. If we were here tonight to talk about energy policy, it would be natural for us to talk about the political activities of oil companies. I suspect I don't need to emphasize that in Dallas. If we were talking about gun control, it would be hardly controversial to examine the role of the National Rifle Association. If our subject was the U.S.-India nuclear agreement, discussing the lobbying activities of Indian American groups would be unexceptionable. But when the subject is Middle East policy, and you bring up the Israel lobby, you are reaching out and grabbing the third rail with both hands. Now, that's partly because this discussion takes place in the shadow of centuries of anti-Semitism, including bizarre conspiracy theories like the Protocols of the Elders of Zion, and, of course, tragedies like the Holocaust. And that history has to be respected because it shapes how people think about this issue. If you talk about a powerful interest group that is mostly, but by no means exclusively, comprised of Jewish Americans, some may think you're saying that there's some kind of secret conspiracy to control U.S. foreign policy. If you say that media coverage in the United States tends to favor Israel, it sounds to some people like you're making the old charge that Jews control the media. If you talk about campaign contributions by pro-Israel groups, some people will think you're saying that money is exerting a pernicious influence in some improper way. It's also hard to discuss this subject because some groups and individuals are quick to accuse anyone who criticizes them, criticizes Israel's actions, or questions American policy in the Middle East, accuses them of being anti-Semitic. Indeed, if you do any of these things, you're virtually certain to get attacked, and that makes it much harder to have a civil or open discussion. So let me make it clear at the outset, my co-author and I reject every one of those various anti-Semitic conspiracy theories. For us, the Israel lobby is an interest group, just like lots of other interest groups in the United States, and most of its activities are as legit or as American as apple pie. We do not question Israel's legitimacy or existence. In fact, we believe the United States should come to Israel's aid if its survival is ever in jeopardy. We also think that the activities of these groups and their impact on American foreign policy is a subject reasonable people ought to be able to talk about openly, the same way we might talk about any other groups that try to influence American policy in any area. With that in mind, let me explain what the lobby is and how it works. The late Yitzhak Rabin once said that American support for Israel was beyond compare in modern history. He was right. It's the largest recipient of U.S. economic and military aid, getting about $500 per year per Israeli, even though its per capita income now is 29th in the world. It's not a poor country like Bangladesh. Israel also gets consistent diplomatic support from the United States, for example, in the United Nations, and we almost always take its side in regional disputes. Israel is rarely, if ever, criticized by American officials, and certainly not by anybody who aspires to high office. The people who are now running for president are going to disagree on lots of subjects, including lots of foreign policy subjects, but all of them are already going to considerable lengths to show how personally devoted they are to Israel. And the question is why? Well, the usual answer is that Israel's a vital strategic asset and that it shares American values. But if you think about both of those things objectively, they can't explain why we give Israel so much help and so unconditionally. Israel may have been a strategic asset during the Cold War, but the Cold War is now over. Today, giving Israel nearly unconditional support is one of the reasons we have a terrorism problem, and it makes it harder, not easier, for us to address a range of other problems in the Middle East. Support for Israel is not the only source of anti-Americanism in the world, and our problems in the Middle East would not disappear if we had a more normal relationship with Israel. But giving Israel such unconditional support is not making Americans safer today, and it's not making it easier to deal with the problems we have in that region. Again, we benefit from some forms of strategic cooperation with Israel, but on balance, it has become a strategic liability. The other argument, of course, is that it's a democracy that shares our values. But again, that can't explain why we give it such large and unconditional support. Yes, it's a democracy, but there are lots of democracies around the world, and none of them gets the same support that Israel does. Israel has about 7 million people and gets billions in U.S. aid every year. India is also a democracy, has a population of about a billion, and it gets about $200 million of American aid this year. Plus, Israel's treatment of its own Arab population, and especially its treatment of the Palestinians, is hardly consistent with American values, and again, undercuts the idea that that's why we should give it such unconditional support. Similarly, it's hard to argue that Israel's conduct throughout its history has been so exemplary that it deserves special treatment. I don't have time to go into details here, but I think any reasonably fair-minded look at the history of the region, including the more recent histories written by Israeli historians, shows that both sides on the Arab-Israeli conflict have done many cruel things to each other. Neither side owns the moral high ground here. Now, please note, I am not saying that Israel behaves worse than other countries do, only that it doesn't act any better than other countries do, and you can't justify such large and unconditional support, again, by saying that it behaves in a particularly exemplary way. I want to emphasize one other point. We both believe there is a strong moral case for Israel's existence, again, based primarily on the long history of anti-Semitism, and we believe the United States should come to Israel's aid if its survival is ever in jeopardy. Fortunately, its survival is not in jeopardy today, and past crimes against the Jewish people do not justify giving Israel a blank check. So if you can't account for this on either strategic or moral grounds, how are we to explain this unusual relationship? And our argument is that the main explanation is the influence of the lobby. What is the lobby and how does it work? It's a loose coalition of individuals and organizations that works openly to influence American foreign policy in a pro-Israel direction. This includes organizations like AIPAC, the Anti-Defamation League, the Conference of Presidents of Major American Jewish Organizations, Christian evangelical groups like Christians United for Israel, the Zionist Organization of America, think tanks like the Washington Institute for Near East Policy, the American Enterprise Institutes, and publications like the New Republic or the Weekly Standard. Now, this is a pretty broad definition. It obviously goes beyond simple lobbying on Capitol Hill. But if you think about it, most special interest groups aren't just lobbyists in Congress. The environmental movement isn't just Greenpeace or the Sierra Club. It also includes think tanks, sympathetic local organizations, academics and journalists who favor a pro-environmental policy, much the same way that the pro-Israel movement does. It's not a centralized organization, and the various groups that actively work on Israel's behalf don't agree on every issue. Some favor a two-state solution, some are adamantly opposed to it. And it's certainly not a cabal or a conspiracy that controls American foreign policy. It's, again, just another interest group that operates the same way other interest groups behave. As I said before, it's as American as apple pie. Final point here, the lobby is not synonymous with Jewish Americans. Surveys show that about a quarter to a third of Jewish Americans don't care that much about Israel. It's not a big item on their agenda. Others do not support the positions advocated by key groups in the lobby. And, of course, some of the groups that work on Israel's behalf in the United States, such as the Christian Zionists, aren't Jewish. The lobby is defined not by religion or ethnicity, but by the positions, the political agenda that it favors. Finally, the lobby doesn't include anybody who happens to have a favorable attitude towards Israel. One has to actively work to try and shape U.S. foreign policy. And again, some groups in the lobby are going to be more powerful, more influential than others. And we may want to touch on that in questions. So how does it work? Well, as most of you know, in the United States, small groups with a focused agenda can often wield disproportionate influence because they care a lot about the issues in question, while most of the population is indifferent, and so politicians can win their support without losing anybody else's. And like these other interest groups, Israel Lobby works in two main ways. First, it operates inside the Beltway, getting sympathetic people elected to office or appointed to key positions, and by giving politicians clear incentives to embrace the positions they favor. Organizations like AIPAC work 24/7 in Washington to convince politicians to support their views. AIPAC has a budget of about $50 million a year. It's very active on Capitol Hill, very efficient, very effective, quite professional, providing talking points, writing letters for congressmen to sign, has an energetic grassroots base. It's a very effective political organization. Now, it's not a political action committee, despite its name. It doesn't give money directly, but it does help guide campaign contributions from individuals and pro-Israel political action committees. These committees gave about $3 million in the last election cycle and have given about $55 million in campaign contributions since the early 1990s. Again, that's not counting individual contributions. That's just from these about 35 or so pro-Israel PACs. By contrast, Arab American political action committees gave about $800,000 in that same period, 1992 to 2006. And over the past 30 years, AIPAC and other pro-Israel groups have helped drive a number of prominent politicians from office, including Paul Finley, Charles Piercy, Cynthia McKinney, Roger Jepson. I want to highlight Jepson for just a second. Jepson made the mistake of supporting President Reagan's decision to sell AWACS to Saudi Arabia. He actually was personally lobbied, had his arm twisted by Reagan himself, and he changed his vote. So in 1984, pro-Israel PACs gave $100,000 to Tom Harkin, who went on to defeat Jepson in the election. And afterwards, former Senator Alan Cranston said that Jepson's defeat, quote, has sort of struck terror into the hearts of senators about switching on Middle East votes. Now, of course, the lobby doesn't win every time, but everyone in Congress knows that you are playing with fire if you question support for Israel. And, of course, that goes for presidential candidates, too. So that's why Steve Rosen, the former AIPAC official who is now under indictment for passing classified information, once put a napkin in front of a journalist from The New Yorker and said, in 24 hours, we could have the signatures of 70 senators on this napkin. Or as Senator Daniel Inouye of Hawaii explained when he was asked why he had signed an AIPAC letter to President Ford in 1975, it's easier to sign one letter than to answer 5,000. Things are no different today. AIPAC was ranked number 2 in a National Journal survey of lobbies in the District of Columbia, tied, by the way, with the AARP. And it was ranked 2nd in a 1997 survey by Forbes magazine. Bill Clinton said AIPAC was, quote, better than anyone else lobbying in this town. And Newt Gingrich, who didn't agree with Clinton on much, said it's the most effective general interest group across the entire planet. Former Senator Fritz Holling said, as he was leaving office, that you, quote, can't have an Israel policy other than what AIPAC gives you around here. Or, as Israeli Prime Minister Ehud Olmert said just last year, thank God we have AIPAC, the greatest supporter and friend we have in the whole world. Now, again, it's not just AIPAC. There's other groups, including, as I mentioned, a subset of the sort of Christian evangelical movement as well. So that's one strategy inside the Beltway. The second strategy is to try and shape public discourse and perceptions so that Israel is always viewed very favorably by most Americans. Mainstream media tends to be very pro-Israel, especially in editorial commentary, in terms of op-ed columnists and pundits. If you compare public commentary and editorial commentary in the United States with either Europe or with Israel, there's just a much narrower range of views expressed here in the United States. There's no equivalent, for example, in the United States of someone like Robert Fisk or Patrick Seal, who write in England, or even Akiva Elder, Gideon Levy, or Amira Haas, who write for Haaretz in Israel. And my point is not that they're always right and that people on the other side are always wrong. My point is that you don't have anyone in the United States writing in a mainstream publication who's at all like Akiva Elder or Gideon Levy or Amira Haas. That voice is largely absent here in the United States. But even so, watchdog groups like the Anti-Defamation League or the Committee for Accuracy on Middle East Reporting in America monitor media coverage, organize boycotts and demonstrations against news agencies whenever they publish anything critical of Israel. So when Jimmy Carter published his book, Palestine, Peace, Not Apartheid, the ADL and Camera took out ads in major newspapers, including the publisher's phone number and inviting readers to call in and protest. Just a few weeks ago, the Jewish newspaper Forward reported that CNN was coming under what it called unprecedented attack for its three-part series comparing Jewish, Muslim, and Christian fundamentalism, and that the Conference of Presidents was urging member organizations to take up the issue with companies that had purchased advertising for that particular program. Finally, efforts to stifle criticism often include smearing critics by accusing them of being anti-Semites. Martin Peretz of the New Republic said that Jimmy Carter will go down in history as a Jew hater, and a critic of the Washington Post said Carter's views in his book were very similar to that of David Duke. Needless to say, this was a common charge leveled at the two of us when our original article on this subject was published, even though there is not the slightest shred of evidence behind the charge. Again, smearing people serves several purposes. First, it distracts people from the real issue, which is American policy in the Middle East. Second, it seeks to discourage people from voicing any criticisms, because who wants to get tarred with that particular brush? And then finally, it serves to marginalize them within the public arena. Would any politician want to associate with someone who's been charged with being an anti-Semite? Of course not. Bottom line is, few, if any, American politicians will say anything remotely critical of Israel, and neither will anybody who wants to be a serious player in the making of U.S. foreign policy. And the result is that on this one issue, there's very little serious debate in the United States, especially in Congress, even when it's obvious to virtually all of us that American Middle East policy has gone badly off the rails. Now, one final point, and then I will turn this over to John. It is sometimes said that the United States supports Israel because there is broad public support for this, that politicians are just doing what the American people want, and so groups like AIPAC are essentially irrelevant or superfluous. This argument isn't persuasive for a couple of reasons. It's absolutely true that Americans do have a pretty favorable image of Israel, in part, again, because media coverage tends to encourage that. But they do not think American support should be unconditional or one-sided. A survey conducted by the Anti-Defamation League in 2005 found that 78% of Americans think the United States should favor neither the Israelis nor the Palestinians. We should be even-handed. Another survey by Americans for Peace Now found that 87% of Jewish Americans favor a two-state solution. A similar poll by the University of Maryland in 2003 found that over 70% of politically active Americans, that would be people like you, favored cutting aid to Israel if it refused to settle the conflict. So again, Americans have a favorable image of Israel. They want it to exist. They want it to be secure. But they are not insisting that the U.S. government back it no matter what. But of course, that's pretty much what our policy is. And that gap between what the American people want and what our policy is due mostly to the political influence of the various groups that make up the lobby. So now the question is, what effect does this have on our overall foreign policy, and is the lobby's influence good or bad for the United States, and I might add, is it good or bad for Israel? And I will turn that easy question over to John. Thank you.
Steve has defined the lobby and made the case that it has a powerful influence on U.S. Middle East policy. I'll take the analysis a step further and argue that its influence has been largely negative. In a nutshell, our argument is that the lobby, working with Israel itself, has pushed U.S. Middle East policy in ways that are neither in America's national interest nor in Israel's national interest. I will focus on two cases. First, how U.S. support for Israel's policies towards the Palestinians in the occupied territories has helped fuel terrorism against the United States. And second, the role of the lobby in the run-up to the Iraq War. There are three other cases that we deal with in the book that I will not talk about here because of time constraints. U.S. policy towards Iran, U.S. policy towards Syria, and U.S. policy during the Lebanon War in the summer of 2006. Let me start with America's terrorism problem. The conventional wisdom among Israel's supporters is that Israel's treatment of the Palestinians has little to do with why the United States is so hated in the Arab and Islamic world, and more importantly, little to do with our terrorism problem. In fact, it is said that Israel is a valuable ally in America's fight against terror. Surely, it is the most valuable ally in the Middle East. This received wisdom, however, is wrong. There is an abundance of survey data and anecdotal evidence which shows that U.S. support for Israel's brutal treatment of the Palestinians in Gaza and the West Bank and U.S. support for Israel's efforts to colonize those territories angers, if not enrages, huge numbers of people in the Arab and Islamic world. The State Department, for example, set up an advisory group on public diplomacy in Arab and Islamic countries, which reported in June 2003 that, quote, citizens in these countries are genuinely distressed at the plight of the Palestinians and at the role they perceive the United States to be playing. Not surprisingly, that anger helps fuel terrorism against the United States. Let me emphasize that I am not saying that our support for Israel's policy towards the Palestinians is the only cause of our terrorism problem. I am simply saying that it is a major cause. Specifically, it motivates some individuals to attack the United States. It serves as a powerful recruitment tool for terrorist organizations, and it generates sympathy and support for terrorists among huge numbers of people in the Arab world. The hostility toward the U.S. generated by Israel's policy in the occupied territories has been recognized by American leaders since 1967, when Israel first conquered the Gaza Strip and the West Bank. This is why the official policy of every president since Lyndon Johnson has been to oppose the building of settlements. But no president has been able to put meaningful pressure on Israel to stop building settlements. Indeed, as Steve pointed out, the U.S. has protected Israel from criticism in the U.N. and given Israel more foreign aid than any other country since 1967 and given it unconditionally. Of course, the reason that no president can put meaningful pressure on Israel to stop building settlements is the lobby. A critically important issue when talking about America's terrorism problem is the matter of how U.S. support for Israel's brutal treatment of the Palestinians relates to what happened on September 11th. It is commonplace to hear Israel's supporters say that, one, Osama bin Laden did not care much about the Palestinians until recently, and he only cares because it is an effective recruiting device. Two, the events on 9/11 had nothing to do with Israel. And three, those attacks, or those involved in the attack, hated us because of who we are, not because of our policies. This line of attack is, or this line of argument, is frequently purveyed by key figures in the lobby. For example, Robert Satloff from the Washington Institute for Near East Policy claims that bin Laden's identification with the Palestinians is, quote, a recent and almost surely opportunistic phenomenon, end of quote. Alan Dershowitz maintains that, quote, prior to September 11th, Israel was barely on bin Laden's radar screens, end of quote. And Dennis Ross, who Aaron Miller describes as Israel's lawyer, says that bin Laden was merely, quote, trying to gain legitimacy by implying that this attack on America was about the plight of the Palestinians. These claims, however, are simply not true. It is clear from the historical record that bin Laden had been deeply concerned about the plight of the Palestinians since he was a young man. That concern was reflected in his public statements throughout the 1990s, well before 9/11. Consider what Max Rodenbach, the Middle East correspondent for The Economist, wrote in a review of two books about bin Laden, one of which was a compilation of his speeches. Rodenbach wrote, quote, of all the themes, the notion of payback for injustices suffered by the Palestinians is perhaps the most powerfully recurrent in bin Laden's speeches. Regarding the actual attack on 9/11, we now know from the work of the 9/11 Commission that U.S. support for Israel was a major cause of the 9/11 attacks. It was not the only cause, for sure, but it was a key cause. For example, the 9/11 Commission reports that bin Laden wanted to make sure that the attackers struck Congress because it is the most important source of support for Israel in the United States. The Commission also reports that bin Laden twice wanted to move up the date of the attack because of events involving Israel, even though doing so would have increased the risk of failure. Finally, and perhaps most importantly, consider what the 9/11 Commission says about the motives of Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, who it describes as the principal architect of the attacks. To quote the Commission report, by his own account, KSM's animus towards the United States stemmed not from his experiences there as a student, but rather from his violent disagreement with U.S. foreign policy favoring Israel. It's hard to imagine more compelling evidence. Hard to imagine more compelling evidence of the role that U.S. support for Israel played in inspiring the 9/11 attacks. Let us now turn to Iraq. It's manifestly clear to most Americans that the Iraq War was one of the greatest strategic blunders in U.S. history. Our argument is that Israel, and especially the lobby, were two of the main driving forces behind the decision to invade Iraq. It is hard to imagine that war happening in their absence. To start with, Israel was the only country besides Kuwait where both the government and a majority of the population favored the war. The Israeli government, to include Prime Minister Sharon, pushed the Bush administration hard to make sure that it did not lose its nerve in the months before the invasion. Other influential Israelis, like former Prime Ministers Ehud Barak and Benjamin Netanyahu, also implored the United States to take down Saddam. In fact, Israel was pushing so hard for war that Israel's allies in the United States warned Israeli officials to damp down their rhetoric, lest it be seen as a war for Israel. The Israeli public was also behind the war, solidly behind the war. According to a February 2003 poll, that's 1 month before the war started, 77.5% of Israelis said that they wanted the United States to attack Iraq. One sometimes hears the argument that Israel opposed the Iraq war and actually favored attacking Iran instead. There's no question that in early 2002, when the Israelis first got wind that the Bush administration was thinking about attacking Iraq, key Israeli officials went to Washington and made it clear that they thought Iran was the greater enemy and that the Bush administration should focus on Tehran, not on Baghdad. It's important to emphasize, however, that Israel was not opposed to the United States toppling the regimes in either Iraq or Syria. Two countries Jerusalem considers mortal enemies. Israel simply wanted the United States to deal with Iran first. But once the Israelis realized that the war party intended to deal with Iran after it finished the job in Iraq, it enthusiastically embraced the idea of invading Iraq. Thus, between early 2002 and the start of the war in March 2003, the Israelis put significant pressure on the Bush administration to make sure it chose war over diplomacy with Iraq, while reminding Washington at the same time not to forget that Iran must come after Iraq. I might add that there is no evidence that Israel warned the United States that Iraq would turn into a quagmire. Turning now to the lobby, there's no question that the neoconservatives were one of the core constituencies in the lobby and that they were the main driving force behind the war. But they were supported by the key organizations in the lobby, such as AIPAC. Now that the war has gone south, it's common to hear Israel's supporters say that the main organizations in the lobby did not push for war. But that is simply not true. This point is made clear in a May 2004 editorial that appeared in The Forward, an important weekly Jewish newspaper based in New York. Let me read to you what The Forward said about the lobby and the war in Iraq. Quote, "As President Bush attempted to sell the war in Iraq, America's most important Jewish organizations rallied as one to his defense. In statement after statement, community leaders stressed the need to rid the world of Saddam Hussein and his weapons of mass destruction. Concern for Israel's security rightfully factored into the deliberations of the main Jewish groups." One sometimes hears these days the claim that AIPAC, the most powerful organization inside the lobby, took no position on the Iraq war and certainly did not advocate it. This is not true either. First of all, this claim fails the common sense test, as AIPAC usually supports what Israel wants, and Israel certainly wanted the United States to invade Iraq. Second, and more importantly, there is hard evidence that AIPAC lobbied for the war. For example, AIPAC's executive director, Howard Kaur, told the New York Sun in January 2003, quote, that one of AIPAC's successes over the past year was quietly lobbying Congress to approve the use of force in Iraq. Again, that's Howard Kaur, not John Mearsheimer or Stephen Walt. The neoconservatives, of course, were the main driving force behind the war. They initiated the idea of using force to topple Saddam in two letters written to President Clinton in early 1998. Over the next 5 years, and especially after 9/11, they pushed relentlessly for a war against Iraq. No other group or institution in the United States was seriously committed to invading Iraq over that five-year period. Indeed, there was significant opposition to invading Iraq within the State Department, the intelligence community, and the uniformed military. The neoconservatives are, by their own admission, deeply committed to Israel. In fact, many of them are connected with key organizations in the lobby, like the Jewish Institute for National Security Affairs, JINSA, the American Enterprise Institute, and YNEP, which is the Washington Institute for Near East Policy. Our argument here, it should be emphasized, is not that the neoconservatives or the leaders of the principal organizations in the lobby were pushing a war that was in Israel's national interest, but not in America's national interest. On the contrary, they believed, the neoconservatives believed, and the lobby's leaders believed, that invading Iraq was in both the American and Israeli national interests. For the neoconservatives, what is good for Israel is good for the United States, and vice versa. Although the neoconservatives were deeply committed to a war with Iraq, they could not make it happen by themselves. They failed to convince Clinton to go to Baghdad, and they had little luck selling the war in the first 8 months of the Bush administration. It was the events of 9/11 that created the circumstances where they could help convince President Bush and Vice President Cheney that invading Iraq was a smart idea. But without Bush and Cheney on board, there would not have been a war. All of this is to say that the neoconservatives were necessary to have the war, but by no means were they themselves responsible for making this war happen. One final point is in order about Iraq. We are sometimes accused of saying that the war was a Jewish war. Nothing could be further from the truth. We point out in the book, as we did in the article, that polls, public opinion polls taken before the war, show that American Jews were 10% less supportive of the war than the general American public. Our argument is that the war was due largely to the efforts of the lobby. Again, not exclusively due to the lobby's efforts, but largely due to the lobby's efforts, especially the neoconservatives within it, but not to the American Jewish community. And as Steve emphasized, the lobby is defined by its political agenda, not religion or ethnicity. Let me conclude with a brief word about what we think the U.S.-Israeli relationship should look like. To start, the United States should end its special relationship with Israel and treat it as a normal country. The U.S. should treat Israel the same way it treats Britain, France, Germany, India, and other democracies around the world. In practice, this means that when Israel is acting in ways that are consistent with American interests, Washington should back the Jewish state. But when Israel is acting in ways that harm U.S. interests, Washington should distance itself from Israel and use its considerable leverage to get the Israelis to change their behavior, just as the United States would do with any other country that was acting in ways that might hurt the U.S. Regarding Israel's conflict with the Palestinians, the United States should act as an honest broker. In other words, Washington should pursue an even-handed policy toward the two sides. In particular, the United States should make it clear to Israel that it must abandon the occupied territories and allow for the creation of a viable Palestinian state on those lands. Jerusalem should be told that the United States will oppose, not tolerate, Israel's colonial expansion in the West Bank. None of this is to say that the United States should abandon Israel. On the contrary, the United States should defend Israel's right to exist within its pre-1967 borders with some minor modifications. And most importantly, if Israel's survival is threatened, the United States should come to its aid. Thank you.
Professors, last week we hosted Mideast Ambassador Dennis Ross here in Dallas at the Fairmont, and he said that your work was detached from reality because you had not talked to anyone who was actually involved in the making of U.S. foreign policy. In last week's issue of U.S. News and World Report, former Secretary of State George Shultz wrote in an article critical of your thinking, quote, "Anyone who thinks that Jewish groups constitute a homogenous lobby ought to spend some time dealing with them," unquote. Would you please respond to these criticisms and tell us how you incorporated into your thesis the real experiences and efforts of actual U.S. executive and congressional foreign policy makers?
Let me make a couple points, then turn it over to Steve. First of all, we did talk to a number of individuals in Washington, including individuals in the lobby, individuals on Capitol Hill, former senators like Adlai Stevenson. But we did not feel it was necessary to do extensive interviewing in Washington, in large part because there's such a rich historical record in newspapers and in books that have been written on the subject. And the direct implication of what Dennis Ross said was that if we had talked to people, we would have come up with a different story. I don't believe that for one second. And if he thinks we would have come up with a different story, he should tell us what that different story would be. And he has not done that. And he, like other critics, simply makes the charge that we didn't interview enough people. Maybe we didn't interview enough people by his standards, but again, the $64,000 question is whether interviewing more people would have changed the story, and I don't think it would have. I want to make one other point about Dennis Ross. I have great admiration for him because, unlike many of our critics, he has not called us anti-Semites or played games with our arguments. He's been a rather straightforward critic, and I appreciate that very much, as I know Steve does. But nevertheless, it's important to understand that Dennis Ross is a central player in the lobby, and he has long been a central player in the lobby, and he is very interested in defending Israel's position in the United States. He likes to give you the impression when he's talking that he is independent of the lobby and there is this lobby out there that he has dealt with before. But in fact, Dennis Ross is part of the lobby. And this is made most clear by Aaron David Miller's comments about Dennis and about himself when they were involved in the Clinton administration in the Oslo peace process. Aaron David Miller said, speaking about Dennis Ross as well as himself, that too often we behaved as Israel's lawyers. This was the point that I made up here. In effect, Dennis Ross is Israel's lawyer, right? He's deeply committed to defending Israel. There's absolutely nothing wrong with this. This is the point that Steve made over and over in his introductory comments. Americans can be deeply committed to Israel. There's nothing wrong with that. But at the same time, it's imperative that we be allowed to point out that people like Dennis see American foreign policy through an Israeli lens. They tend to think that what's good for Israel is good for the United States and vice versa. And we think that no two countries can ever have the same interests, and therefore it's very important to have an open discussion about how supporters of Israel might think about American foreign policy.
Let me just say a couple of words about former Secretary of State Shultz and his comment. First, the U.S. News and World Report article that was mentioned here is actually drawn from the foreword he wrote to a book by Abe Foxman that came out. Actually, it was timed to coincide with the release of our book. So one thing to note about it is that Secretary Shultz, of course, wrote his foreword before our book was published, which means he hadn't read our book when he wrote that. Second, we made it clear in the original article and in our book, and I hope I conveyed it this evening, that we never thought of this as a homogeneous group. That this is a series of groups, a loose coalition that has some policies that they agree on, but many things they differ on. So again, it's not a monolith. It's not a homogeneous. We agree with him on that. And then the last thing I want to do is I actually want to read a passage from the book where we quote Secretary Shultz's own memoirs. And there's a slight contradiction that some of you may detect. In early December 1982, he writes, I got word that a supplement was moving through the lame duck session of Congress to provide a $250 million increase in U.S. military assistance to Israel. This in the face of Israel's invasion of Lebanon, its use of cluster bombs, and its complicity in the Sabra and Shatila massacres. We fought the supplement and fought it hard. President Reagan and I weighed in personally, making numerous calls to senators and congressmen. On December 9th, I added a formal letter of opposition saying that the supplement appeared to endorse and reward Israel's policies. The supplement sailed right by us and was approved by Congress as though President Reagan and I had not even been there. I was astonished and disheartened. This brought home to me vividly Israel's leverage in our Congress. I saw that I must work carefully with the Israelis if I was to have any handle on congressional action that might affect Israel, and if I was to maintain congressional support for my efforts to make progress in the Middle East. That's what Secretary Shultz wrote in his own memoirs. I frankly cannot account for what he wrote more recently. Thank you.
Thank you, professors. I have several written questions. In the interest of mixing it up, I'm going to alternate between questions from the floor and the written questions. So let's take a question from the floor. Yes, sir, right here.
Thank you. In your presentation, you said that you had been, that you had been asked, why didn't you include Bush administration and those who were directly concerned with the decisions that were made concerning Iraq? And you said it wasn't necessary, because you had so many other sources. I would suggest that had you gotten their opinions who are 180 degrees different from your opinions, and I would like for you to comment on that, why you didn't include them, because including them would have made a fair presentation.
There's no doubt about it that there are lots of people in the land who would argue that Israel had nothing to do with and the lobby had nothing to do with the Iraq war. And there are a number of other people who don't have much evidence who would argue the opposite. And the way you determine whether or not Israel and the lobby played a key role in causing the Iraq war is to look at the historical record very carefully, talk to as many people as you can, and then come up with a decision of your own. And we went over the historical record very carefully. We wrote a lengthy chapter on the subject. We provide extensive documentation for our position. You certainly have the right, and others have the right, to disagree with us. And it may be the case that 20 or 30 years from now, when more of the historical record is available, that we're not infallible. We made a good faith effort to look at the evidence, and based on what we saw, we came to the conclusion, again, that the lobby and Israel were two key players driving the train forward, but were certainly not the only players.
The next question is a written question. The question is, what will the role of the Saudis be in resolving the solution to the Israeli-Palestinian problem? Will the U.S., United Kingdom, France, and Germany go along with the Saudis in resolving the fundamental Middle Eastern question or problem of the Israeli-Palestinian problem?
I think almost everyone realizes that getting the Israeli-Palestinian conflict solved once and for all in a way that grants the Palestinians a viable state and grants Israel a safe and secure future would be in everybody's best interest. I can't think of countries that would seriously oppose that, with the possible exception of Iran. But even a number of Iran's leaders have said it very, not Ahmadinejad, but some of his predecessors have said that they would accept any settlement that was acceptable to the Palestinians. Certainly all the European countries would welcome this because they all realize that this is nothing but trouble for everybody. And, of course, Saudi Arabia in 2002 and then again last year reiterated a peace plan that virtually all the Arab governments endorsed, which doesn't have all of the elements of a solution spelled out in detail, certainly, but certainly acknowledges Israel's right to exist, says it wants to live in peace. So, I mean, again, I think the Saudis are being constructive as well, and the key now is to get the Israelis, the Palestinians, and the United States behind a more serious effort than we've seen in recent years to try and end a conflict that's not good for anyone.
I'm going to take this question next, and then you, sir, will be after that.
Go ahead, sir.
Yes, could you explain the theology behind evangelical support of Israel?
I could talk for a long time about this, but I won't. There is a subset, and I emphasize that it's a subset of the Christian evangelical movement that draws its theology from what's known as dispensationalism. And the basic idea here is that that what's going to happen in the world is preordained in the Bible, in biblical prophecy, and a key element of that is the restoration of the Jews to the Holy Land, and in particular, controlling all of the Holy Land. So the conquest of Jerusalem in 1967 in the Six-Day War was seen by dispensationalists as a sign that this is all going to come true. And, of course, the retention of the Holy Land is part of then what will eventually bring about the Second Coming, the Rapture, and all this. If you want to know more about this, and I don't recommend it as literature, but if you want to know more about this, Reverend John Hagee's book, Jerusalem Countdown, spells out all of this. For this reason, this subset of the evangelical movement, sometimes known as Christian Zionists, are not only very strong supporters of Israel, but very strong supporters of a maximalist territorial version of Israel. It's not just that they think Israel ought to exist, but that they believe the Bible specifies that Israel, or the Jews rather, should control all of former mandatory or former mandate Palestine. So they are on the very hardline element. But again, it's not for strategic reasons. It's not really for moral reasons. It's based on their particular reading of both of primarily Old Testament and some New Testament prophecy. My own view on this one, for if it's not already apparent, is church and state are separate in the United States, and biblical prophecy is not a particularly sound basis for making American foreign policy.
Just very quick. I was going to say, just very quickly, a number of Christian evangelicals recently wrote a letter to President Bush protesting the mainline Christian Zionist position that Steve just articulated and saying that they were in favor of creating a viable Palestinian state. And that gets back to Steve's earlier. Many people, including, I believe, the vast majority of American Jews, understand that it's important to create a Palestinian state and get this conflict behind us as much as possible.
Next question. The Holy Land Foundation trial has been being held here in Dallas over the past 2 months. In the trial, the U.S. government has used evidence provided by the Israeli government and two Israeli security officers, one of whom testified anonymously. Can you speak to the implications that this has for legal precedents and the rule of law and how the Israeli and the Israel lobby might be involved?
I don't think we can answer that question because I'm embarrassed to say that we don't know anything about the case. And if there's one thing I've learned in writing this book, it's that it's very important not to talk about something you're not absolutely sure of. So we'll take a pass on that one.
Right here, sir.
Thanks. You've given examples from 1982 and examples from last year. Do you see the Israel lobby's influence as ascending, descending, stagnant over that couple of decades? Or
I think its impact has grown over time. I think it's more influential now than it was. If you go back to 1981, the AWACS sale, they lost. They didn't lose by much. And some would argue that it was actually a sort of long-term victory because the Reagan administration had to work so hard to get the AWACS sale through that they wouldn't push very hard subsequently. But that was a long time ago. And I think it's become, increasingly, some of the groups like AIPAC have continued to rise in sort of the amount of money they control, size of their budgets. Once you've knocked off a few congressmen and senators, everybody gets the message, so you don't have to do it very often. And just to give you a hint of some of the impact here, and sorry to tell a story about ourselves, but some of you may have picked up in the press this past week that the New York Sun brought to the attention of the Obama campaign that when you went to Amazon.com and you clicked on our book, right, that you got a Obama for President ad on the side on Amazon. And this had nothing to do with us. This is because the Obama campaign had purchased time on space on Amazon for anybody who clicked on books about politics. Right? So the New York Sun then asked the Obama campaign about this, and I think that there's still a dust trail being left by how quickly Senator Obama and his campaign ran away from the book. Right? Now, again, that's his, he's entitled to take that position. But surely it is odd that in this an election year, instead of having a debate about all aspects of American Middle East policy, there's one aspect where all of the candidates seem to be having a competition for which one can demonstrate the greatest fidelity and devotion to Israel. That's peculiar given that American politicians argue about everything else, but not about that.
If I can just make one addendum to what Steve said. The basic argument we make in the book, especially in the conclusion, is not a hope that the lobby will go away or its power will be greatly diminished. I don't think that's going to happen. Our basic argument is that we hope that the lobby develops more enlightened policies or pushes more enlightened policies, policies that are more in Israel's interest and in the Americans' interest.
Or that the more moderate groups within it become more influential, which would also serve the same purpose.
Israeli intelligence was brilliant in getting U.S. soldiers to die on the front lines for the preservation of Israel. Since the 2003 invasion, no suicide bombers have surfaced in Israel. They are gathered around U.S. soldiers like flies around a honeypot on the 4th of July. In view of the latest Israeli test flights over Syria, do you think that President Bush and Vice President Cheney will bomb the Iranian nuclear facilities before leaving office, thus successfully completing the greatest triumph of the Israel lobby?
You want the Iran question?
Yeah, I'll take the Iran.
Okay. Well, just as a general point, the fact that Israel tries to get the United States to do certain things for its national security, for Israel's national security, is not unusual in international politics. All states go to great lengths to get other states to do the heavy lifting for them. The United States has a very rich history of this. I wrote a book called The Tragedy of Great Power Politics, and one of the core concepts in that book is called buck passing. And buck passing is where one state tries to get another state to do its dirty work. So the fact that Israel tries to get the United States to do X, Y, or Z is not unusual in international politics. And to be perfectly blunt, there's nothing wrong with it. Our argument is that the United States should resist that kind of behavior by Israel when it's not in our national interest, just like we would resist that kind of behavior if Britain or France was pushing it. With regard to the terrorists and the fact that Israel has pushed all of its terrorists away from Israel onto the United States, I think this argument is not sustainable. We're dealing with two different sets of terrorists here. Hamas and Hezbollah are not major problems for the United States. They're major problems for Israel. Our major problem is al-Qaeda. And fortunately for the Israelis, they at this point in time don't have a major problem with al-Qaeda. And the fact that Israel has done a good job of shutting down, not completely, but almost completely, its suicide bomber problem is not because it sent those suicide bombers to Iraq or to any other country. That argument is simply not sustainable by the evidence.
With respect to Iran, I think neither of us and nobody in the room knows if the United States or anyone else will take military action against Iran in the next 18 months. Ultimately, that's a decision that's going to be made, you know, by President Bush. And there are clearly people in the administration that have pushed in that direction. There are clearly people in the administration who think that would be a bad idea. And I don't know which of those groups is going to win out. What I would say is the only groups and institutions in the United States who seem to be pushing hard for a military strike on Iran are some of the same groups that pushed for us to go into Iraq, right? Sort of the same players, the same publications, some of the same individuals, certainly some of the same organizations. So if the war were to happen, it will be President Bush's decision. And, you know, his close advisors. But again, I think the outside the administration, the main driving force will be some of the same groups there. I will just add, I think this would be an unfortunate decision in the extreme because it's not going to solve the Iranian nuclear problem long term. It could only delay it and give them even more incentive to try and get it. And it certainly is going to cause further problems for us in the region and probably elsewhere. That is not to say, by the way, that the Iranian nuclear problem isn't an issue that we ought to be paying a lot of attention to, just that a preemptive strike is probably not the solution.
I'm going to take two more questions from the floor. This gentleman first, and sir, you right here will be the last question.
Quick comment. You left off Republican Jewish Coalition as one of the lobbying organizations that supports the State of Israel. Quick question. The American Enterprise Institute a few years ago estimated that if we did not have the military presence of Israel defending America's interest in the Middle East, their military presence, it would cost us, the United States, approximately $10 to $12 billion a year to maintain that same type of military presence to support our allies in that part of the world, including Saudi Arabia. I'd like you to comment on that, please.
Well, the fact is that Israel does not defend their interests militarily in the Persian Gulf or in the Middle East more broadly. It never has. Up until 1968, we depended on the British to do our heavy lifting. This is another example of buck passing. We depended on the British to do our heavy lifting in the Middle East. And then after 1968 and up till 1979, we depended on the Shah of Iran, not on Israel. And then when the Shah was toppled in 1979 and the United States greatly feared not only a revolutionary Iran, but we worried about the possibility of the Soviet Union attacking into the Middle East, what we did was we developed a rapid deployment force of our own. We did not rely on the Israelis because we could not rely on them. And in fact, we did not station any of the pre-positioned equipment for that rapid deployment force in Israel. We deployed it in other countries in the Middle East. The two most glaring examples that show that Israel is not an asset when it comes to fighting wars are the first Gulf War and the second Gulf War. We had a large coalition of countries that went to war with us in 1991. There was one country that was conspicuously absent. That country was Israel. It didn't fight with us. In fact, we had to defend Israel from Scud missile attacks. With regard to the 2003 war, Israel did not go into that war with us. I'm not saying that that's because Israel is not a loyal ally, or I'm not saying in those cases that it was buck passing either. It was just the fact that given the politics of the region, there's no way that the United States could rely on Israel to do its heavy lifting in the region. And we'd have to either depend on other countries like Iran and Britain, or we have to do the heavy lifting ourselves with the rapid deployment force and the military forces that we brought to bear in both 1991 and 2003. But Israel is not our savior on this front.
I'm going to add just one clarifying point there. You can make an argument that Israel was a strategic asset during the Cold War, helping defeat Soviet clients, Egypt, Syria in various wars. It's not an open and shut case, but you can certainly make that argument. The reason, of course, it's not an open and shut case is that our support for Israel is one of the reasons that those countries then wanted to get help from the Soviet Union. But still, the key point to understand there, though, is the Cold War is now over. And therefore, the Cold War argument that they were helping us defeat Soviet communism went away in 1991, as lots of people acknowledge. So the question is, to what extent is Israel a strategic asset today? And the fact that they didn't participate in those two wars is not because necessarily Israelis didn't want to. It's not like they were lurking behind us. It's just as a practical matter, they couldn't help because that would have destroyed the coalition that was trying to fight against Saddam itself. So again, it's not to say, again, that they're being disloyal or anything like that. It's just as a practical matter, we can't depend on Israel to defend our most important strategic interests in that part of the world. And of course, the most important strategic interest is oil, and Israel is not in a position to help us very much on that particular problem.
All right, here will be the last question of the evening. Yes, sir.
Yes, thank you very much. I wanted to start with that phrase that you cited and did not agree with, and I don't either, that what's good for Israel is what's good for the United States. But I wanted to carry that a little bit further. You made a very convincing case that the activities of the Israel lobby have not been advantageous. They've been negative for U.S. foreign policy. I want to ask whether you think the activities of the lobby have been advantageous, have been positive for Israel over the long range, Israel's long range interests, a country that presumably would like to live one day. It hasn't been able to do it about 60 years so far, but to live with neighbors who are friendly. What effect has the lobby had on that interest of Israel? Thank you.
One of the themes that we repeat throughout the book is that we believe many of the policies the lobby has encouraged have been unintentionally harmful to Israel as well. I want to give two examples very quickly. The first and most obvious one, and John alluded to it, is the settlements policy. Many Israelis now recognize that the settlements program was a costly strategic blunder that greatly worsened Israel's strategic situation, created a really terrific problem for them, and that if it had never been undertaken, they would be much better off today. And, of course, the United States would have been a better ally for Israel if we had stopped that before it got started. We would have been a better friend. But, of course, although American presidents all understood this and often said that they thought settlements were a bad idea, none of them were ever able to do anything to stop the settlements project. Again, we would have been a better friend. And the main reason, of course, they couldn't do it is that the political consequences of trying to exert American leverage on Israel, I think, would have been too great. So that's one example. The second example is the Lebanon war in the summer of 2006. All right, Israel had a clear problem with Hezbollah, clearly a threat there, and they had a right to respond when Hezbollah did what it did. But the response the Israelis had developed, which they had been planning for some time, was a foolish and immoral response. It was a disproportionate response to an obvious provocation, and more importantly, it wasn't going to succeed. Trying to disarm Hezbollah from the air or by bombing massively throughout Lebanon was not going to work. But instead of either telling the Israelis to come up with a better plan before the war, or once we saw how the war was going, shutting it down quickly, something that would have saved Israeli lives as well as Lebanese lives and wouldn't have given Hezbollah as big a political victory, would have been the right policy for the United States. But that's not what we did. Congress passed a resolution supporting what Israel was doing by a vote of 410-8. Any congressman who said anything remotely critical were immediately criticized. So here's another case where the key organizations in the lobby were encouraging a policy that wasn't good for the United States,
It wasn't good for other countries in the region, and certainly wasn't good for Israel. And, of course, the Israeli government commission that evaluated their own conduct in the war, the Winograd Commission, reached the same conclusion, that this was a disaster for Israel. And, again, we weren't a particularly good ally by encouraging them to go down that unfortunate path.
Just to come at your excellent question from a slightly more general perspective, the fact of the matter is that all countries in the world sometimes pursue foolish policies. We all know as Americans that the United States has on occasion over the years done some stupid things. And the United States is not exceptional in that regard. It just goes with life in the international system. Therefore, it's very important that people in the United States be able to criticize their government and have an open and freewheeling debate about what we plan to do and then how we should deal with it once we go out and get ourselves into trouble. Debate is a good thing. Criticism is a good thing for maximizing the chances that states will either not pursue foolish policies, or if they do pursue foolish policies, will figure out the best way to get out of the mess. Now, the situation that we have with regard to Israel is that we give them unconditional aid. No matter what they do, even if it's foolish, they get backing from the United States to the hilt. This is not a good thing. Furthermore, we can't really have a meaningful debate in this country about Israeli policy. It's very difficult. Steve and I could tell you from personal experience, it is very difficult to criticize Israel. This is really crazy because Israel is not perfect, because there is no such thing as a perfect policy. And it makes eminently good sense, not only from America's point of view, but from Israel's point of view, to have a situation where Americans can criticize Israel when Israel does foolish things, like all countries do. And the Lebanon war is a perfect case in point. Steve and I have been in the business of international security for a long time, and virtually everybody in our community understood that the Israelis were pursuing a remarkably foolish policy in Lebanon. This was a non-starter from the get-go. But you couldn't get on television or on the radio and say that, or get an op-ed in the New York Times or the Washington Post saying that. It just was out of bounds. And again, the end result is that Israel ends up in a real mess in Lebanon, as Steve pointed out, and the United States ends up in a real mess. So what we're trying to do here with the book, which I think is all for the good, is just to open up the discussion. It's not to punish Israel. It's not because we hate Israel. It's because we believe that an open debate fosters smart policies, not only for the United States, but for Israel.
Thank you, Professor Walter Mearsheimer. Ladies and gentlemen, please don't go home tonight without an autographed copy of the Israel Lobby, and I'll look forward to seeing you at our next event. Thank you.
For more information about the World Affairs Council of Dallas-Fort Worth, visit them on the web at www.dfwworld.org.